come down and let you in. I'll come down and let you in. I'll come down and let you in, cried the fair young maiden.
I'm Barnacle Bill, the sailor man. I'm Barnacle Bill, the sailor man. Hey, hold it there, gang. Now, before you start laughing, hold it now. Come on, crowd. I know I don't know the words. Before you start laughing, I think it's very unfair that you haven't given me a chance to get really unlimbered here. Get the clinkers blown out now. Let's get them blown out now. Terrible unfair people. Now, I know there is a song that goes like that. I just know this because it was burned into my hide like a branding iron when I was about four. And we had this record. And it was always being played on our wind-up phonograph. And it was always saying that. Was there such a song? Did anyone ever hear such a song like that that said, I'll come down and let you in. I'll come down and let you in. I'll come, don't you? Is there a song called Barnacle Bill the Sailor? I didn't think so. I must have invented it. I'll come down and let you in, cried the fair young maiden. I am Barnacle Bill the Sailor Man.
Something like that. I had about nine different voices. If I had the lyrics to that, I would sing it for you tonight. If I had the lyrics to Barnacle Bill the Sailor. Of course, I know there are some lyrics that would not go over well in Queens at this hour of the night among, shrafty ladies, but I think secretly they would dig it, because I think every shraft lady of my acquaintance would like to be quietly be asleep there under her patchwork quilt when all of a sudden there is the thunder at the door.
Oh, let me in, I'm Barnacle Bill, the Sailor Man!
Well, of course, they would pretend they're mad. And all that stuff, but secretly there would be a terrible, it'd be obviously not.
I'll come down and let you in. I'll come down and let you in. I'll come down and let you in, cried the fair young maiden.
Come on, baby. I'll give you the brass finger, Gabe, if you can tell me who sang like that.
Got it.
Do you ever hear any guy sing like that? No, not me. Come on, that's silly. No, there was a guy who made a big deal singing like that. Yeah, he became very famous, as a matter of fact. And it was a very terrible thing. While we're on the subject of terrible things, and it's pretty late, and it's almost later than you think, we've just discovered that there was no such song as something called Barnacle Bill the Sailor Man. No, and I'm glad to report to those of you who were worried about it that is true. Speaking of terrible things, did you see any of the candidates on television, any of you guys? Nothing is sadder than a candidate who has just been told that he is not very popular. I was noticing a couple of guys, and of course the protocol for a candidate who has just been told he is not very popular is always the same. It's something like this. I want to thank all of you here who work so hard and so long. I want to tell you that we here at the headquarters are not discouraged by what the voters obviously did today. We've been looking very carefully at the figures, and although it may at first glance seem that certain things happen, we, after having looked at the figures very carefully, realize that other things happened which have not yet been brought out. For example, there are many people who felt that we would not poll 1 out of 7 votes among the so-called popularity balloting here in this state. Now, I would like to say this before we go any further. This is not a very, very important polling up here. This is just a slight indication of how possibly things might possibly go if we do not campaign harder in our next hustings. And, you know, this is kind of embarrassing. Everybody's sort of standing around trying to look at Charlie the other way. And I think one of the things that all of us hate, have you ever really stopped to think about why we all hate politics? Why so many people will be very down on politicians, although we're all fascinated by politics? We all sit glued to television sets and radios whenever there's a big election. I don't think there's anything more exciting than the big election going on. This is the biggest sporting event in the world, and everyone is involved, and you're really with it. You know, somehow you're really part of it, too. You can't get excited over a horse. You know, how can you identify with Mongo or you know, Blue Arrow or some of the big old fat horse standing out there? You can only identify with the $2 you got riding on the nag's nose. You know, you really, but people really do identify with politicians and with issues and one thing and another. And yet, I've been intrigued by the growing put down that people put on politicians. You know, they always say, "Ah, he's a politician. What do you mean, a ridiculous politician? Oh, silly." And yet they can't stay away from it. You've heard this, Don. More and more guys will say, "Ah, you know, politicians." And yet I was watching. I was really carefully watching all the television reports and everything. I was really curious about this, and I was watching the candidates making the appearance. And I began to have that slight feeling of embarrassment that we all have when somebody has had a big party. You know, he tells everybody he's going to have a big party, and you show up at the party, and half the seats are empty, and you know he's laid in 14 cases of beer, and there's only 7 guys around to drink it. You're kind of embarrassed, and you don't really want to say anything. You say shit from one from the other. And you feel like slinking out into the dark, you know, hiding in the snow or something, or hiding behind the bushes or something. Well, there's a funny thing. I think in connection with that, I suspect that this is one of the reasons why we're beginning to slowly be anti-politician, because as we get more and more into this day of non-individuality and nobody going out on a limb and everybody playing it safe and everyone taking a very well-established line and a very well-established position, that we can't somehow abide a man who is standing up now, really standing up and laying it on the line and says, "All right, we're going to see whether or not I'm popular or whether you love me or not." You know what I'm saying there? We all have a secret fear of the vote being taken on us. Can you imagine what would happen at the office tomorrow if at 9 o'clock when you arrive in the office and they say, "Tomorrow we're going to see whether Don Williamson is more popular than Eddie Zajac." Oh, boy. and so they start, so that, you know, you don't know what to say. So you try to buy a guy a Coke, you know, Don. You say, "Hey, how about Ralph Schlegel? How about coming back and having a Coke with me?" And you buy him a Coke, and Eddie gets up on the swivel chair back there in production, and he gives the guys a speech about how, you know, how they're going to have longer coffee breaks and stuff like that. And then by the end of the evening, at about 6 o'clock, just before you're ready to knock off work, they all start dropping their little ballots into the suggestion box here. And by 7:30, it turns out that 80 Zajac draws 2 votes out of a possible 798. Well, well, what is Eddie going to do, you know? I mean, how are you going to come back to the office the next day?
We all have that secret fear of the vote being taken. And we all suspect vaguely it is being taken all the time. It's being, you know, very unofficial. But it is being taken. I can remember that terrible thrill that would go through you when you're in school. You remember when they decide you're in about fourth grade, and they decide they're going to have an election, and they're going to elect who is going to be, let's say, some nutty little thing like, who is going to be the class monitor? And they start nominating guys. All right, who wants to nominate somebody? Somebody jumps up and says, I'll nominate Alec Josway. And, you know, you want to be nominated. That's the sad fact of it. You have a secret desire to be nominated. You want to be nominated, but you're deadly afraid of the vote being taken. I think all of us would like to be nominated, and we'd like to quietly withdraw before they cast the ballots. You know? And so then that awful thing when they say, I want to nominate Gene Shepard. Oh, well, that of course, it's happened to every one of us, I'm sure. But I remember a devastating election that was held in 5B. And it was one of those rotten, sneaky things where it's out of your hand. You know, they put your name in for the thing, and you cannot withdraw. And so what happened was there were four of us that were nominated. There was Alec Josway, there was myself, and there was a chick. What was her name? A tall, skinny chick, sort of a blonde. Oh, I remember Smith, Dorothy Alice Smith. Alice, a tall, skinny girl, blonde girl. And there was another guy, a little short, fat guy named Weiss. And all four of us, he had just come to school, you see, this guy. And how he got nominated, I think he nominated himself. And what they did, what they did was to drop things into a hat. The teacher went up and down and says, we're going to nominate who is going to be the kid who's going to be the class monitor. Now, the class monitor is kind of the class big shot. He's the, you might say he's the steward, you know, the shop steward. And he would take roll and all that stuff and stand around and see who's late and so on. And it was kind of a favored position. Well, everybody wanted it. And there we were. All four of us were standing in the hustings. And so they had the voting. And I'm in a terrible cold sweat. You know, what is this? Of course, you're excited that you're up there. Your name is on the board. And this nutty teacher, who I will never forgive her for this, Miss Nelson, this nutty teacher decides that we're going to have the voting, and all the kids wrote down on a piece of paper, you know, who they want to have, and they put them all in a box. A kid walked up and down the aisles, and they put them in the box, and then another loudy kid would count them after they were all taken up to the front, and another kid would write them on a board, one after your name, you know, little lines. You have no idea how terrible it is to see this one kid with all the lines going after his name, and you got one or two, you know, and it goes one, two, and they keep name. Oh, it's a terrible scene. It's a terrible scene. Speaking of the unpopular, this is WORAM and FM New York, and you got a little whoopee thing in there, Don?
Welcome aboard, sir.
Thank you. The ailment.
Your stateroom is ready, sir.
What a pass.
The captain would like you to dine with him.
Me? Here I am riding on this rum runner, you know. Scarface is driving it.
Can I get you anything, sir?
Yes. I'll tell you, sir.
You thirst for adventure.
Why? Well, but you want
something new.
Hey, these guys don't listen.
Try a Valentine ale. This one.
It's all an act.
Older, keener, more to the point.
Yeah,
suddenly,
yeah.
You're a confirmed Valentine ale.
Hey, whoopee! Here we are. Oh, it's great. All right.
Who is the ale man? Who could be you? A man with a thirst for a
manlier brew.
Three out of four men.
Nothing is worse than a bunch of chicks drinking the manlier brew.
Keener tasting ale. Valentine.
Very interesting commercial. There is that funny thing. And of course, you get mad at a guy who really will and who has the guts to stand up and say, "All right, I'm willing to stand up and let them count the votes on me." That really bugs people. It bugs you. It bugs yourself. You resent it. You really do. And I think that is connected with the fact that, say, Lodge, for example. Lodge didn't do any of that stuff, you see. So people are not bugged by Lodge. He didn't go around and talk and say anything.
He didn't maintain anything, what he's for or against, anything like that. And somehow, he does not irritate you. But in this day and age, of course. I think it would have been literally unthinkable for people, say, 50 years ago, to vote for a guy who did not campaign, who did not give any speeches, who did not say what he was for. It would have been unthinkable, really. But today, we so resent a guy getting up and talking that we're bugged by him. I suspect that the harder a campaign is fought these days by guys, the less chance he has of winning. Could very well be that way. I think we've turned a very interesting milestone here. And in the end, we will vote for a total abstraction, not a man. We don't want a guy that gets up and stands and looks embarrassed and talks and hollers and argues with other people. And I suspect that eventually we will vote for a kind of abstract man, that's maybe a cartoon man. You know? Have you ever had the feeling that you'd vote for Donald Duck if he ran? Yes, a cartoon man could very well win it these days, because a real man is controversial. You know, he's too short, or he's too fat, or he's too tall, or he breathes, or he snorts through his nose, or his eyes water a little bit. You know, all those terrible things that we have come to look for in weak, poor humanity. And I suspect that the eventual giant dictator of us all will be an enormous composite man that will have been created by some future Walt Disney and will appear only on television and will be literally an abstract, in a sense, symbolic man. We will vote for him, and he can't make anybody mad. He will be no discernible race. And more importantly, he will be no discernible sex. Sex in itself, you see, is undemocratic. It immediately divides people into two camps right there. And so if you can come up with the non-sexual candidate, now I don't mean asexual, I mean non-sexual, just a sort of big plastic candidate that can be any sex you want. You just sort of look at it a certain way, whatever you want. And there it is, and it says all the great things, and has perfect anger. Now, do you know that you can be too passionate and people get worried? Literally. The people who share your same passions, you can be too passionate, they don't like that. You can be too bland, and they don't like that. And so the eventual perfect candidate will be, I suspect, designed and created by some gigantic computer machine that will create the perfect candidate for all the 48 or 52 or 729 states we may have by then. That they will be polled automatically. Do you know that cars have been designed that way? Automobiles have been designed, and there has been no designer involved at all. They merely discovered the various preferences of the 87 million guys for grills, what preference they like for back ends, how they like the seats, what color, how big they like it. And they feed it into a big machine. Out comes the 64 model, all beautifully designed, and there it is. And they just have to, you know, make the little dies and put it together, and it goes out on the market and sells 87 billion copies. Now, a lot of people will tell you that the Edsel was done that way. It was not. It was not at all. Be very careful before you pop off too quickly and say that. The myth is that the Edsel was done that way. I'm sorry. It was not, because in the end, you see, what would happen every time they got the results of their polls with the Edsel, they didn't believe them. So they didn't do it. That's true, you know. That's one of the great errors that the Edsel people made. And so it turned out that everybody wanted a smaller car. Well, they didn't believe it. They thought it was a louse up in the polls. They said, no, what do you mean? People want bigger cars. So they turned out a big car. In a year when everybody wanted smaller cars. Well, the giant IBM wouldn't make that mistake. And I'm looking for the day when each political party will have some sort of an enormous machine that will determine what the people want, literally what the people want. And we will be presented with two composite men. One is an inner-directed man, and I think roughly the differences between the two parties are those. One is an inner-directed man, and the other is the outer-directed man. I feel that these are the two designations that we could apply to the Republicans or the Democrats or the conservatives or the liberals. One is inner-directed, the other is outer-directed. And so we will have two masterfully created inner-directed and outer-directed men who are so beautifully contrived, though, that they do not offend even the other side. The other side is willing to accept him. And, of course, the side for which he is created will be insane about him. Now, he will be mechanical. He will be some kind of a mechanical contrivance. He will, because more and more you'll see in the ads that the mankind is being distrusted by men now, literally being distrusted. In fact, one insurance company has a TV spot that comes on, and it shows a whole bunch of whirling discs. Have you seen that one? And tapes are going back and forth, and then there's a quick shot of 1,001 cards being shuffled by the fingers going through it. And the announcer comes on and says, "Your insurance needs are now calculated without the old-fashioned risk of human error." How about that? The machine now tells you what you need, how long you're going to live. There's no such thing as human error. Well, of course, machine error is fabulous. When a machine error goes like 10 million times beyond human error. Did you see the little bit in the paper? Here's a little tiny one. Listen, from Indianola, Iowa. Listen to this little bit. The mechanical age, this is from the Times. And in Iowa yet, the mechanical age finally caught up with Kenneth Hatcher, manager of the local Agricultural Stabilization and Conservation Service office. He put in an order for 5,000 paper clips. But due to an overzealous electronic billing machine, he received 5 million paper clips. They arrived by semi-trailer and weighed nearly 5.5 tons. Well, now, you know, human error is something, but it never goes quite that far. I can tell you this, because when the machine makes an error, it makes a colossal error, a really bomb of an error. I mean, it really, boom, the whole thing goes up. Man may miss the target by 7 feet, but when the machine misses it by 9 galaxies. Believe me, when it hits it, sure. Did I ever tell you my little experience with the giant mistake that the machine made? Well, let me tell you that little story. Boy, I'll tell you, it scared if there was anything that put years on me at the age of 17, it was this. I was working as a mailboy in the mill there, and we were running back and forth in the mill all day long. We're getting about 4 cents a day, that kind of thing, because we were considered to be under a very special category as executive employees, you know, executive trainees. That's one way to get a guy to be in slavery. And that was a gambit they were running in those days. And of course, you work 45 hours a day. And you worked 6.5 days a week, and you ran 17,000 miles in 1 week. And you had to memorize the name of every last straw boss in the mill. And you could also have to read his idiotic scrawl. Now, they'd write this stuff down, you know, and you're running, and the whistles are blowing, and the horns are honking. And of course, the cacophony, and the wild, insane smells, and the feeling, and the thunderous roar of the steel mill has to be felt. You have to be there. I couldn't describe it to you. It's like trying to describe war. That there were some parts of the steel mill where the ground itself has been shaking for as long as the mill has been there. The ground just... It's going... They had a place called the Drop Forge, the number 2 Drop Forge, that did that. It was a giant forge. What it was about an 87-million-ton hammer. And they would... They put these big chunks of metal in there, and they were making locomotive castings. They kept talking about things like locomotive castings and bridge castings. And big things they'd make. And this big hammer would come down at about 18-second intervals, day in and day out. Boom! And the ground jumps up and down 1.5 feet. And you can be 25 or 30 blocks away, and you feel the ground like an explosion. And the closer you get, it goes... One casting is done. And then... Boom! It's this kind of scene. So you get pretty dull to the machine world out there, and you begin to be a part of the machine, but not really a part. Is the oil a part of the machine, Don? Not really. oil working in a machine is not part of the machine. It's in the machine. It's burned up by the machine. It makes the machine work smoothly, but is not part of the machine. Well, human beings are oil to giant machines. Human beings are the oil in a big factory. They're not part of it. They make it work better. It certainly burns them up. It burns them up quick. Oh, yes, believe me, a man after 25 years in certain parts of the mill is deaf. His eyes are vaguely glazed because of the heat. Oh, yes, that's true. He has lost all his hair because of the heat, and he's developed a kind of strange tic where he can't sit still any longer. When you live in a sea of sound, silence is excruciating. I know guys who would retire. I knew one old guy who retired from the drop forge, and I knew two guys in the chipping mill who got finally transferred after 20 years out of the chipping mill. They've been trying to get out of the chipping dock for years. They finally got transferred to some quiet place like the lakefront scales, and by the end of the third week were screaming and climbing up the walls, and they had them put them back into the middle of the chipping dock where the sound was healthy and ga-ga-ga-ga-ga-ga-ga. And, they could fit with it, sure. Why, many a guy leaves New York City and goes completely ape when he gets up into Maine just because he misses the feel of the BMT going under his feet. He misses the scream of 6th Avenue traffic. He does, really. Do you know what you can buy today? If you think I'm being fun, listen to this ad now. I think I got it here, yeah. You can buy a machine now. It's called a SleepMate. You can buy a SleepMate machine that reproduces for you no matter where you go, and it comes battery-operated, too. You see, if you get way up in the country, someplace way out in the woods, it reproduces the sound of traffic artificially, or the sound of an air conditioner. It is not an air conditioner. It's a little thing that's... Now, are you trying to tell me that we're... And this thing is selling, you know. It's a big scene. And guys are plugging them in all over. You know, they feel good. They can hear fist fights and everything else going on when they plug it in, and they feel okay up there in their cabin in Maine. Well, you get like that in the mill, and of course you get so that you're kind of immune to the machine, just like oil must be used to bearings, you know. And you run around, and I'm a part of the machine now. I've got the steel-toed capped shoes, the whole bit. I'm wearing the helmet and the goggles, and the sparks are flying, and my ears are vibrating for hours. I would get out of that mill. I want to tell you this. I would get out of that mill, and for at least an hour and a half, I was shouting, and people were shouting at me. I'd come home dead tired. You just can't believe how tired you get. And I would sit there, my eyes glazed. I would be falling over the dinner, you know. I just started falling down. My mother's giving me the hamburgers or whatever. And I would hear this sort of this hum in my ears. And my mother would say, don't you hear what I'm saying? And I wouldn't hear a thing. My ears are still going. I can hear the number 2 AC show. And I'd say, what do you want? And she'd say, well, will you? Shoo! She'd jump back, you know, make the big take. And my kid brother would say, will you quit yelling? Why? What do you mean yelling? Of course, that's the way you talk in the mill. You just yell back and forth. There are some guys who have worked side by side, cheek by jowl, with, say, old Henry in the pickling shop, who have not spoken in a normal voice to each other for the 30 years they have known each other intimately. And I remember, guys, there's a place called the pickling mill down at the end of the tin mill that is composed of enormous vats. They're lined with enamel, and it's these tremendous vats. They're about 25 feet across. They're about 8 or 9 feet high, and they're filled with hot H2SO4. Oh, yeah, it's hot acid. And the steam is rising out of these things, and it's just like, it's right out of Dante, and the steam in the room is H2SO4. It's sulfuric acid. And you walk around there, and these guys, you know, they're used to it. Their lungs are made out of solid leather or enamel or something. And their hats fall off. They slowly disintegrate, and, you know, they come apart. And old Hank is down there, and all these guys, and this place dips the sheets in. It's dipping the sheets of tin into the H2SO4 for a certain process of annealing this tin. It's a certain process, and they're just... It's going like this. It's like about 25 fantastic washing machines. all going at once, filled with hydrochloric acid. If you think Mr. Clean can stand up next to sulfuric acid, forget it. I'll tell you, it's H2SO4, not hydrochloric. It's sulfuric acid, and it's hot. And so the tin is coming in one end, and it's going out the other end. It's wet. The floors are wet. These guys are running around wearing rubber boots, and they're wearing T-shirts, which fall off of them because the H2SO4 dissolves them. Their skin literally is pickled. They look like gnomes. They really do. And they have been living, and they're paid on tonnage. They're very high-paid guys. And they really know what they're doing. And they're a very tight group. It's like a suicide squadron. And they have these, and they drink and yell and holler, and they run around. And you go into this room, and it's total, just total chaos. The noise is incredible. And, of course, you can't breathe. Your eyes water. Immediately you feel your earmuffs dissolving right on your ears. And you feel your skin sort of getting that real bitey feeling, you know, that you have when somebody has put some crazy stuff on your skin that it burns. Well, these guys, you know, they're sweating and old O'Brien there is in charge, see? Yeah, you've heard me talk about O'Brien, the greatest man I ever knew. O'Brien was the greatest man I ever knew, literally. O'Brien was about 6.5 feet tall, and he loved the pickling mill. And I would come in to see O'Brien, and O'Brien looked like Slim Somerville. He was tall and skinny, and he smoked twigs. He had these Italian cigars, you know, that looked like little twigs that bend all over the place. These real stinky little twigs, black little things, and he's smoking these things all the time and wearing the straw hat. And you could always tell the new season had come, O'Brien would show up with his straw hat from the preceding summer. He would, and it would just completely dissolve over the winter. And you could tell the summer's coming up by the size of O'Brien's hat. And by the time the summer arrives, O'Brien's hat is falling off his head, and he's ready for another one, you see, and that's O'Brien. So O'Brien is brown because of the pickling. Well, these guys, all 18 or 20 of them, were all like O'Brien, and they were all brown because they were pickled in H2SO4 after 100 years of working in this department, and nobody else came near them. You know, there are certain departments which do such devilish work in any big outfit that everybody's afraid of the guys. They're very temperamental. And it's like some kind of a suicide combat group of soldiers. The guys in the signal corps don't mess with them, you know. You just stay away, and you send them the radios, and you run back. You don't want to say anything. Well, that was what was going on there. And I would come running into this place with their little bit of mail. They'd get a little mail once in a while. Some little fat thing would come wrapped in brown paper, and O'Brien would take it, and he would holler something unintelligible at me. Hey, they're bringing the mail in there, hey! And he would holler, and once in a while I would come in, he'd say, sure, it's Shepherd. And he had this wild Irish accent. Sure, it's Shepherd. He says, Shepherd, I put in for a transfer. You're coming to work in the pickling mill. Sure, we're going to have you in the pickling mill. And I go, no. He says, sure, the transfer's coming. Come on, boys. Shepherd. And he would laugh and yell. They knew their work was so terrible that whenever they were gagging with other guys, they would always threaten them with drafting them into the pickling plant. So, anyway, I would run through this plant, and it's going like mad, and you knew these guys never talked to each other in normal tones of voice. They couldn't, because it ran 24 hours a day. The minute you would get there, it would be screaming. It didn't stop. All 27 of these pots are going, and it's just an insane sound. Well, one night, I happened to be down at the bowling alley when the pickling guys are bowling. They are down there. And there is O'Brien wearing a new straw hat, and he's got a twig in his mouth. He's brown, and he's with all the other guys. He's with Shaughnessy. He's with Myers. He's with the whole crowd from the pickling mill. They're all brown, and they're all sweating. They're wearing shirts now, you see. And on the back, it says pickling department, you know. They're bowling. I had never seen them bowl. And you could tell the difference immediately. You'd see all like 35 alleys, you know, all the lanes. All the other guys are kind of white and fat, you know, and they're bowling. There's the shipping department from the coal strip, and there's the accounting department. And right in the middle of it is this little knot of hardened, grizzled combat soldiers. And they are all brown from the pickling, and they're yelling. They are all yelling at each other. They could not talk to each other. No, hey, O'Brien! And they're yelling, O'Brien! And you could hear all the other guys, you know, talking normally and yelling, you know, once in a while. But down there on Alley 22, you could not hear yourself think. They brought the pickling mill in with them. Well, I am one day running through the mill, and this is getting back to the gigantic mistakes that machines can make. I have seen mistakes that machines make that you would not believe. I remember one time when in the hot strip, they had a giant automated, beautifully automated, integrated, transistorized, high-speed transport system. Now, a transport system is a system that runs a long ribbon of metal. It looks like about a yard across, and it's about a thickness of a good-sized piece of paper. Maybe it's as thick as a piece of cardboard, thin, maybe poster board, like that. And it is sort of cherry red, and it goes ripping along through this automated, transistorized, highly integrated transportation system in a gigantic, endless ribbon at about 60 miles an hour. I don't know whether you've ever seen a ribbon of metal clipping along at 60 miles an hour, but let me tell you, it raises the hair on the back of your neck. And it goes whipping through there, and it goes... It snickers, you see. It goes... And it's going like mad, and it's about 4 million miles long, and it just goes... And somewhere way down at the end of the mill, which is a mile and a half long, it is being cut into strips or being put into rolls or being done something to. And all the while, this giant ribbon is going... And it's red hot. Well, one day, old Shep comes clipping through this hot strip, and he makes the turn to the left, and he goes up the long flight of iron metal stairs up to the drop forge department in the hot strip where they have a little office, and he's dropping off some mail. And suddenly, he hears down there, whoop, 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 whoop. All the whistles are going. I'll tell you, if you think a ship under fire from the enemy is anything, you ought to hear what happens when the hot strip goes out of control. It's going, whoop, whoop, whoop. Well, all the guys jumped up in this office, and I don't know what's happening. What is it? And I run out on the metal platform, which was about 19 or 20 feet above the floor, and down below us, this machine had somehow gone astray. And this metal is just piling up. Have you ever seen these candies, these Christmas candies, that look like ribbons that are all folded together in loops? It's going, grong, 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 and it's just piling up. And somewhere, way down at the other end of the mill, the steel mill is feeding it in at 60 miles an hour, and it has stopped where we are, and the whistles are going, and the guys are running like ants, believe me, when the Flytox is brought on the scene. They are screaming and running, hiding under the water coolers, and it's going boing, da doing, da doing, da doing, whoop! And it all stopped. Well, there must have been at least 45,000 tons of red-hot strip metal all piled up in... It must have been 45 feet high because, these mills are enormous, big metal buildings. And it was piled up in peculiar-looking pyramids. And it was laying in great ribbons all over the machines. And there were little fires burning all over. Wherever this would fall across a wooden desk, the little wooden desk is flaming. It's going... And guys are running around, and a couple of guys have got these little tiny fire extinguishers off the thing, and they're squirting a wastebasket. And you can hear way down in the distance, you hear little alarm bells going ding, 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 ding. And finally, they got everything shut off, and there was a dead silence in the mill. And everyone sort of stood around and looked. They didn't know what to do. Nobody knew for a minute there what to do because the machine had taken over so completely that you had kind of abdicated. You kind of gave up. It's like I'm sure that girls who operate in the mechanical switchboards, all those big automated switchboards down at the Bell Telephone Company, if one day they have to work a mechanical automatic, switchboard with the plugs, they wouldn't know how to do it anymore. Well, everybody in the mill was stumped. They all sort of stood around. And heat, the heat was just rising out of that place, and you could smell oil and things burning, and the machine was all twisted and laying there, and no one knew quite what happened. Well, of course, there was an investigation, and the investigation started the minute that I walked out, and I laid my mail down, and I got out of there, because it was like seeing the death of King Kong, It was like seeing the Empire State Building slowly sink into Staten Island Bay, you don't know what to do. You just go. I mean, I go. You know, I'm running. And I can see for miles around as I go out into the mill, I can see the ambulances coming. You know, guys were hurt all up and down the line. And I could see the ambulances coming, and I could see guys in the other mills. Hey, what happened over the coal strip? It wasn't the coal strip. The hot strip. No, I heard it was the coal strip. You know, it's like a giant army. The rumor spreads out what happened. And I'm about 5 miles away now, and I'm way over someplace near the open hearth. And the guy in the open hearth is telling me, he's saying, hey, I hear the tin mill flying shears blew up. What'd you hear? And I'd say, no, it's the hot strip. He's like, oh, come on, you're out of your mind, the hot strip. What do you mean? They got that automated system down. It's not the hot strip. I heard it was the flying shears. And the rumor goes, and everybody's scared, you know. Oh, there's a terrible fear running through everybody. I get back to the main office, and, of course, they're all waiting for me. I'm the guy from the front because the word has come back. The word has come back from the front office that there has been a giant, almost complete disaster in the hot strip, and I have just been on the hot strip route. Well, I came running into the office, and they're all waiting, and Snyder says, hey, come over here, Shepard. And everyone's gathering around. What happened in the hot strip? What happened in the hot strip? I says, I don't know. It all blew up, and the guys of the... And we could hear out there, whoo! You could hear the ambulances going for miles around. The time the machine got out of hand. And, you know, for days after that, of course, they had the place roped up, and they pulled all the junk out, and they got it fairly going after a while. But after that, you know, for weeks... When I'm running into the hot strip, I would have a funny feeling. I would run into the building, you know, and I'm sort of looking. Up to this point, it had been the most innocent and innocuous of buildings. Just that little, you know, that little snickering sound. And here, all the while, I was afraid of the wrong buildings. I had been afraid of the plate mill, you know. Somehow the plate mill scared me. Hot strip was fun. And from that minute on, I had that sink, you know, that funny sick sensation when I'd run into the hot strip. And I would run like mad along those machines. I'd way over by the wall, you know. I'd go ding, 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 ding. I would deliver my mail. I'd ding, 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 ding. Out into the... I'd run like mad. And I would get into the open hearth, which all of you people probably are afraid of. And I would breathe a sigh of relief. Oh, boy, the old open hearth. Boom! It's blowing, you know. And off. They're tapping the heat. Boom! And I'd feel at home, you know.